In 1973, I was invited to spend a weekend as the guest of a minor Austrian aristocrat at a magnificent castle just outside Vienna, Schloss Enzersfeld. The name was resonant, but I was 21 and unprepared for how deeply the emotional history of the castle would seep into me. I was greeted on arrival by an array of liveried servants who, over the next 3 days, provided for my every demand, as well as several I could never have anticipated. Dinner was elaborately and terrifyingly formal, served in a baronial dining hall for a handful of guests, who included the aging German actor, Kurt Jürgens. The waiters stood stiffly in the corners of the room as I played with my foie gras. The rest of the meal passed in a haze. Then I was led along a cold stone passageway to my bedroom, a 10-minute walk away. The next morning, the man who had invited me, my own small-scale princeling, drove me around the estate and gave me a detailed history. I had entered an unknown and hitherto unknowable world. Although I had just started working as a journalist for Reuters, this was not a story for the wires. I could not find words to write about what I had seen and was experiencing. I lacked both the context and the emotional maturity, but I knew instinctively that I was playing with fire. How smoothly such luxury, and we are talking here about Hermès scarves, not Cartier jewels, could permeate the pores of my life. I have thought about those 3 days many times since, and never once regretted my decision not to see my Prince Charming again. Less than 40 years before, this castle had been the refuge for a former British monarch, henceforth known as the Duke of Windsor, immediately after his abdication from the British throne. Eugene de Rothschild and his wife Kitty had offered it to him as he waited, bored, and with mounting nervous tension, for the woman he loved to become his wife. He had left his country plunged into a deep constitutional crisis. No one knew what the outcome would be as Europe bristled with threats of war. Yet his concern, as he paced the corridors of the castle at Enzersfeld, was to fill his bedroom with dozens of photographs of this woman. He telephoned her several times a day, at considerable expense, at the chateau in France where she was similarly imprisoned. Phone lines were primitive, so they had to shout at each other, and many people were close enough to be listening, as well as some who were paid to listen in. Lawyers insisted they must not meet, or the divorce might be jeopardized. He passed the hours knitting a sweater for his love. She, in turn, sent him dozens of letters, lamenting the situation in which she found herself and longing for the time when she had the protection of his name. This was, unquestionably, not a scenario she had foreseen. Christmas came and went, and the Duke, the increasingly heavy bags under his eyes, telling the world that he was hardly sleeping, morosely attended church in the village of Enzersfeld. When his hostess, Kitty de Rothschild, left the castle, the Duke failed even to say goodbye. He was still without the woman he had told the world he loved, the woman for whom he had given up a kingdom, the woman who still had two living husbands, the woman for whom he had sent himself into this hellish exile. 40 years later, the scenery of the castle remains as sharply engraved in my brain as ever. Those who know only one thing about British history in the 1930s know about the king who abdicated because he could not continue without the help and support of the woman I love. Yet many people cannot imagine who such a woman could be, one who could exert such a powerful magnetic force on a man groomed from birth to do his duty as head not just of Britain, but of a great empire that stretched from India to Canada and Australia, the Dominions as they were then known. Because they cannot imagine such a woman, they have invented an image of her, a process which began in 1936 and which gathered pace in the ensuing half century. In the pages that follow, I want to examine whether that picture is still valid in the 21st century. I want to let her own voice speak wherever possible, however rasping as her detractors insist it was. It may not always be a sympathetic voice, but it will, I hope, help readers understand what it was in her background or makeup that caused her to act or speak as she did. I hope to humanize rather than demonize the woman known as Wallis Simpson, to see her within her own social, historical, and geographical context. Very simply, I want to start by understanding what sort of woman she was, and then look at the crisis in which she was embroiled. Money is often an important part of this story, but in the text, I have always quoted the actual, contemporary amounts. As a very rough guide, these figures can be multiplied by 50 to give an idea of the value today.